Hi everyone, my name is Ashi Schreier, the rabbi near Israel Forest Hills, and I'm the head of the private paid division of Caring Professionals and the coordinator in Caring Professionals, which is a home care agency, a licensed home care agency. We send people to help the elderly in the five boroughs and try to make things go as smooth and as well-run as possible. That's always the goal. I'm here with Rabbi Dr. Aaron Beck. It's an honor and a privilege to be sitting up here with him for a lot of reasons, but it's really great to be here, so thank you all so much for coming today. Now, it could be, because I am in home care, that I've always been fascinated with the end-of-life situations where some of our great leaders in our past have been. The Torah tells us about the passing of Aaron HaKohen. Aaron, who was one of the great leaders we've ever had, and how amazing the end of his life was, and how Moshe Rabbeinu, his brother, wanted to have the same type of ending. And the Gemara tells us it was kind of like Nishika. That's the name of the death that Aaron HaKohen had, because it was so pleasant. It was like taking a hair out of milk. Something which was nice and pleasant, and Moshe so desperately wanted the same thing. And eventually he was granted that same thing. And there's a lot of discussion about the end of life in the Torah, and I've always been fascinated by Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov was in Mitzrayim, and the Medrash tells us that Yaakov was the first person to ever get sick. Before Yaakov Avinu, no one got sick. People sneezed and died, and that was it. And that's, some say, is the reason why we say God bless you or Gesundheit after someone sneezes, because it used to be a sneeze and that's it. So there was no sickness, but Yaakov Avinu wanted some sort of warning as to when the end was going to come. He wanted to have an end of life situation where he can prepare and maybe talk to his children. And we see at the end of his life, he's surrounded by his children, and he gets to give them blessings, and he gets to really see everyone before he goes out. And it really kind of changed a lot of years ago, but it really kind of changed the way that end-of-life care is set up. And even though he might not have been in his ideal place, he was in Egypt, and eventually he was taken down to Israel, but he had a situation where he was in his house, surrounded by his family, and he was able to live in a very respectful and dignified way until the very end. You know, being in the home is something which is very powerful. I was talking to my grandfather, who's been in healthcare also for quite some time, and we find something very interesting. When someone passes away, oftentimes the family sits Shiva, they mourn, in the house of the deceased. And it's a nice thing to do. There's halakhic ramifications to it as well, but practically it's a nice thing to do because you see where the person lived, how the person lived, the various elements of their life that maybe you wouldn't get that full picture if you were in someone else's house. My grandfather told me, maybe this is behind what we say with Hamakom Yenachem Eschem. We say a very interesting language of giving comfort to people. And we know, everyone points out, this word Hamakom that we use for God, it's a very strange thing. We use it by the Seder also. And what we're trying to say is that even in the most difficult of times, when we feel most distant from God, God is still there with us. He's Hamakom. My grandfather wanted to suggest that maybe Hamakom Yenachem, this place where we are, where we're sitting chilling right now, where we are mourning over the loss, maybe that could also be some sort of comfort. To see that person lived a nice life in their house, you could tell a lot about a person from their house. I think they did a profile on Rav Ovadia Yosef before he passed away in Israel. And the whole profile was just going through his house and analyzing based on his house, the way he lived. And you saw there were books everywhere from the second you walked in until the second you were gone. That was how he was determined to live, and that's really what you were able to see from his house. So it's something which is very comforting. And nowadays we're very lucky that there's modern medicine and that there's so much technology that's able to allow us to live longer and to have longer lives. Baruch Hashem, and thank God that it's really something that we are able to have people that live a lot longer than ever before in history. It's something which is truly incredible, but also technology allows us to have the home care that is necessary. A lot of the things, and rehab centers and various centers and facilities and hospitals are amazing and they're wonderful, but there's a lot of things that you're able to do in the home as well. And being in the home, there's a tremendous advantage to having that regular setting, to having the familiarity, to having everything really in the same place. It's really something which cannot be overstated. So having this familiar place is something which really should have a lot of credence when trying to make decisions towards the end of life. But unfortunately, we don't always know when this type of thing is going to come. We don't know when it's going to happen. I know I get calls all the time from someone who just fell and they're in the hospital, they're coming out, and they can't be alone. What are we going to do? And it could be someone who is fully healthy, someone who is never having any issues, but all of a sudden it kind of creeps up out of nowhere. And hopefully no one will ever need any of this, no one will ever have to discuss with any of us any of these things, but it's something that certainly needs to be planned for. You know, they say, there's a saying in Judaism, kol haschalos kashos, all beginnings are difficult. And I once heard a beautiful idea that the problem is really the solution as well. Kol haschalos kashos means that all beginnings are difficult. New stages are tough. So what do we have to do to fight against that? Kol haschalos kashos, we, towards the beginning, we need to be kashe. We need to be tough. We need to be strong. We need to make sure we are informed, and we need to make sure that we ask a ton of questions. No one should settle because they don't know enough. No one should settle because they're not sure what to do. You should inquire. Make sure you find the right people to ask. There's so many resources out there, and it's something that you need to be prepared for at all times. So with that background, home care, again, is something which kind of creeps up. So I just want to go through some of the ways that home care can exist and some of the paying methods, some of the ways that people can interact with it, so that way we can go ahead and educate in some capacity, and we'll have questions at the end and really get some sort of at least a basic understanding of what it is. Because so often, as I mentioned before, I get these calls and it's just overwhelming. It's a new stage. People are, they just don't know what to do. And it's fully understandable because it's a totally new stage and it's just something that we should know about. So to start with hospitals, and Rabbi Glatt will correct me with anything, I'm sure. But a basic overview. If someone, let's say, has a fall in the hospital, if someone ends up in a hospital and now they're coming home and they need some service, so there are options, there are things to potentially do. Number one, most people, anyone who's over 65 has Medicare. And when you have Medicare, the social worker in the hospital should be able to arrange that you get a Medicare stay, a CHA visit, Certified Home Health Agency visit coming out of the hospital, which means that short term, you should be covered for OT, PT, nursing visits. Included in that comes a few hours of home care. So normally standard hours would be, let's say, 5 days a week for 4 hours a day for 3, 4, or 5 weeks. That's for the short term, to take care of this episode. You had a fall, just to know that there is something in place, and it's there. If you're over 65, it should be there, and it could be set up without any issues, is something which is so important to know. Then there is Medicaid, and Medicaid is really crucial because these costs of home care and really of all medical care can certainly add up. And when it comes to Medicare in New York, there's a lot more freedom than maybe in other places. You're able to put your assets into some sort of trust, which is going to be discussed a little bit later from the legal element. We also have a person who works with this to know that this is an option. I think one of the lawyers likes to say that they can get anyone onto Medicaid, even Bill Gates. Okay, that'd be interesting to try that. But Medicaid is certainly an option. And the way it works is you put these assets into some sort of trust. Once the assets are in a trust, you qualify for Medicaid. You would get an evaluation from the general Medicaid people. You would then sign up with what's called an MLTC. And I know a lot of these phrases might be foreign and might be random, but it's important just to have some sort of familiarity with them in some capacity. But you sign up with an MLTC, a managed long-term care company. There are many of them. You can pick which one you would want to go to. You can figure out which one you get referred to, whatever it may be. And there they make an assessment and determine how many hours you are worthy of or you are able to have for free. So let's just say a standard case. They can come and say, you need 7 days, 7 hours. And then for free, you have 7 days, 7 hours through an agency, either of your choice or one that they assign you with, and that would be something which is free and obviously something which is important to look into. Then there's what's called the private pay element of home care, where simply you pay privately and you are able to go through an agency for that. And obviously people have the various chats and they go through whatever it is, but there are different advantages to using an agency, namely that if someone doesn't show up one day, there will be a replacement sent. There's someone who, there are options, you know, there are a lot of people, I guess, in the pool, so you can work and pay privately. But even that adds up and becomes expensive. So many people have bought into long-term care policies throughout their life, and this is the time to access that. A lot of times they'll cover, depending on the plan, every plan has their own quirks. Some people have $300 a day will cover. Some people have 10 hours a day will cover, depending on each individual plan and each individual quirk. So many people that I interact with have been paying into these plans forever, but they just don't know anything about it. And then they have this plan just sitting there, and then they're spending all their own money without even knowing that they have the ability to access this. So it's something which is very important to know, just to know that you have all of these options and that they do exist and that there's things to do. It's something which is so important, which could really make a tremendous difference to the end of our life. And our goal, I know, as an agency, is to find that right shidduch. View it like shidduchim. We try to find that right match. And so many people have seen shidduchim, right? So many people have seen that we have different situations where you have a home attendant that really becomes part of the family and really is, you know, at the funerals and they're thanking the first five people are, you know, you made their life so wonderful. Being a rabbi, you get to interact with both ends of the spectrum. So I get to see the home care part, and I get to do, unfortunately, a lot of funerals as well. And just seeing the impact that home care can have on the end of life is something which is really inspiring and something which is just really important to know about. So just to summarize again, we spoke about the importance of the home and the importance of knowing some background before you get into a new stage. And we said there's Medicare. Anyone 65 and over, you should know that you have short-term care available. After any sort of episode, either a doctor's note or a hospital stay, you have the ability to get OT, PT, nurse visits, even home care for free, even though that might only be in the short term. There's then Medicaid, which takes a little more planning, and you should talk to a lawyer or talk to people to figure out at what point is it worth it to maybe look into putting assets into a trust, or maybe you have an old elderly parent who, thank God, doesn't need anything right now, but it's something certainly to think about as to maybe when we can get them onto Medicaid, because that's more long-term care and a plan that can be in place for the long term. And then lastly, there's the private pay worked with long-term care insurance, either private, you could just pay for it, and then there's a lot more flexibility, and really accommodating, really respectful. It's a nice way to have a person live. And also working with long-term care insurance is so many different people pay so much money for so many years into these plans, but don't even know what they have access to. So remember, kol hatchalot kashot, that it's new stages are difficult and it can be overwhelming and it's something which can be difficult at first, but you need to approach it with that same tenacity. You need to be able to fight it strong and don't be afraid or embarrassed to ask any questions. Continue to ask and know what you are eligible for, because you don't want to lose out on anything that you may actually have. On that note, thank you everyone for listening. We're going to hand it over to Rabbi Glass.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be with my good friend, Rabbi Schreier, here as well. So I'd like to talk some very, very specific halachic situations that come up with end-of-life care. I'm not your posek unless you ask me to be. I do function in that way, unfortunately too frequently. But the most important thing I can tell you is aseh l'chol rav. Every person needs to have a rav who's an understanding of the situation. Rav, a person can be a baki in all four sections of Shulchan Aruch, but not be familiar with some of the end-of-life issues. Now, Maisa Shahadi just happened to me last week, which I still am shaking from, that I got a call never from a family of a patient that was dying, and literally the patient died about 3 or 4 hours after I spoke with them. And they called me crying because the person that they had been referred to Paskin the Shiloh for them and told them the following statement. So to this day, I still am amazed that somebody could say, and I wonder if they just made a mistake in misunderstanding what the Rav said. The Rav was a chashuv rav, a nachas hashom, in any way, ever, going to castigate a gadol b'torah. But the understanding that they had from this rav was that the patient had to die from the cancer and could not die from anything else. In other words, you had to do everything possible for this patient, despite the fact that the patient was in pain and suffering. And Lania's dati, that's certainly just a misunderstanding, and I'm assuming that they misunderstood what the rav said. There are many, many, many different great gedolei poskim, both contemporary poskim, Shem Yarach Yomim, that they should be with us to help us with these very difficult shailas. And Rav Mechaim Lechaim, we have great gedolei from the previous generation who passed many of these shailas, and they passed them sometimes in different ways. If you look at the Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Waldenberg is at Tzal, Moshe Feinstein, Hebrews Moshe, the Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, the Shlomo Zalman Zatzal, the Yashi Zatzal, all these great, great Gedolei HaPoskim from the previous generation all had a totally different approach to some of the most difficult shaylos that we could possibly ask. And I always have to remind people that you don't paskin in a vacuum, that a person needs to paskin based upon the entire situation in front of them, not just from a simple fact that they've been told, and that what may be correct in one situation, in a similar situation, but not identical situation, psak halacha to be absolutely the opposite. And I've had many times people come in and say, my Rav said, do everything. You can't have a DNR. You must resuscitate. You can't have a DNR. You do not intubate. You must intubate. And when he has got the, that is not the psak of any gadol that I'm aware of. And even if you take the quote, most machmir position of some of the gadolim, so even they, under specific situations, don't hold like that. So it's critically important. The single most important thing that I tell people to do is aseh lecha rav. When Baruch Hashem everyone is healthy, when these shaylos have not yet come to a critical point, the family needs to decide who the rav is. I never also have to go and visit families in a shiva visit. And I have to visit this son at this family sitting shiva, and this son at this family's sitting shiva, even though they're brothers or sisters, because Nebuch, these situations can sometimes tear apart a family. And when the children have different rabbeim, this one went to Lakewood, this one's in the Wayu Kolo, this one is married to Saul and his rabbi there. And Nebuch had the opposite of this one, her rabbi, she said to do this. So you have different approaches and different hashkafas, kasher, non-kasher, in the children. And who do you follow? So it should always be the person who's six, rub. They went to them all their life. They daven in their shul. They daven by them. The rub knows them. Even in a situation where the rub doesn't know them, they have to pick a rub that the family will agree on to paskin the shaylos. It is the worst thing in the world when you have one son saying, my Rosh Hashiva said do this. And the other one says, my Rosh Hashiva said that that's murder if you do that. And this one says, no, the other way around. And never. I wish I could say these are rare occurrences, but they're very, very common occurrences. And it's critically important that the family, not just the nifter and the terrorist, the one who's having the end-of-life situations, should express their preference, but they should express them to the family. And all the children have to be masculine, as long as it's a kosher authority that they're seeking. You can't say, well, we don't hold for him. He's a kosher authority. You may not hold for him, so when you have to pass these shadows for yourself, you can go to your rug. You go to a different posek. But if it's a legitimate posek and they wish to use that posek, it is critically important that all children in the family, because it's usually the children that's a problem. It's rarely the spouse that has a disagreement. They usually are like this, especially if they've been together for a long time. And they never have sometimes lost. They're often incapable because of emotional concerns, sometimes because of age, because of their own infirmities, to deal with this. It's often, not almost all the time, left to the children to deal with. That brings up the halachic and medical ramification is who should be making these decisions. And that's why it's critical that everybody in this room, everybody outside this room, identify who their healthcare proxy should be. Who will be the person that will be making these decisions for them if they're mentally incapacitated and incapable of making such a halachic medical decision? Do you wish to have intubation in this situation? Well, who is your rav? What is your hashkafa? A kosher hashkafa, yes or no? Is this obligated? Is this permitted or not obligated? Is it sometimes usher to do resuscitation? Sometimes it's usher to do resuscitation. The person may have the status of a ghost, with zero chance that it will work. All you're doing is potentially causing pain and suffering. And then you're a chogel. You might even be doing things that are going to bring about their petira faster. And it's usher to do some of these things. You must decide who is going to possibly shine this for you. And that should be usually the person who's sick or their family rug. If there's a clear decision who that should be, it solves a lot of problems. Nobody can say, well, my rug says this life. Don't ask your rug. You can't ask the shayla, except for the person that the shayla is asked to. And once the shayla is asked, you accept the psak halacha. It's a legitimate psak halacha. You may have others who disagree. Your rabbi may give a minority opinion. You can say there are other opinions that say the otherwise. The halacha lemaisa, practical consideration, as a practicing rabbi in the community and as a person who deals with these things at our hospital, Nebuch, unfortunately, every day. These are shilas that must be clear and defined who's going to pass the shilas. The next most common problem that comes up is not knowing what the shayla is. People come up to me all the time in shul. One of the favorite shaylas I get, standing online Friday night, everybody wishes to love the Shabbos. And they say, can I ask a quick question? I said, sure. Should I be taking this antibiotic on Shabbos? Am I allowed to take this antibiotic on Shabbos? So I asked him, who are you asking? I asked him, Rabbi Glad or Dr. Glad? You ask him, Rabbi Glad, your doctor says you're supposed to take it. So then, you're allowed to take it. If you're asking Dr. Glad, I don't think the antibiotic's indicated. And you shouldn't be taking the antibiotic. Not on Tuesday and not on Shabbos. So you have to know the shayla. It's critically important. And the only way you know that is if somebody with a medical background is discussing the shayla with your rabbi. When I tell people who should they choose as their healthcare proxy, I always say, you have 7 children playing off. Everyone wants to be the healthcare proxy. So my two criteria are not who's the biggest Talmud Chacham, not who is a man versus a woman. My two criteria are who lives nearest and will be there at the hospital all the time. Don't tell me that the Bukhar, he lives in California, he's going to be the healthcare proxy because he's a Bukhar. He has no clue what's going on. He's not there. He's not speaking with the doctors. It's a mistake to make him the healthcare proxy. He's the smartest son. He's the favorite son. He's the oldest son. Those aren't halachic criteria. The healthcare proxy has to be somebody that's going to sit there and talk to the doctors. And if you have the luxury, the second criteria is somebody who's in the healthcare field. Not doctor if they're a doctor, but somebody that understands the lingo, somebody that can understand what the doctors are saying. I can't tell you how many times people come to me with a shayla, the doctor said this, and then they tell me what the question is. And I say, there's no way the doctor said that. It's just wrong. I know the medicine. There's no way a doctor could have accurately told you what you're telling me. And then I say, let me speak to the doctor. And they always say, yeah, they have a problem. And the doctors usually don't have a problem. Some doctors talk to the rope and again, but the majority are not. The majority of the doctors will be more than happy to speak with a clergy person, be more than happy to have a clergy person come and discuss it with them at whatever family meetings that they have. As long as the family says it's okay, they're happy. Because it usually makes them have less hassle and less trouble. And when you are the rav, you must speak with somebody that knows the medical facts on the patient. Because otherwise you're passing incorrectly. You can't pass him in a shemayim. You can't pass him through Ruach HaKodesh. You can't pass him because you know Abachal Kishulchan Aruch by heart. You can only pass him if you know what the facts are. And many times, it's a game of telephone. Your kids, you play telephone. So he tells him, he tells him, he tells him. So the patient heard it from the family member speaking to the Rav, heard it from the other family member, heard it from the doctor. And there was already several mistaken transcriptions along that way. Not going to go to the rabbi who doesn't understand the medicine. It's a setup for disaster. And these are the Rulo Shalom. These are the most lofty of shilas they can be. These are the Kuat Nefashos fighting death shilas. So I always tell doctors, when I'm talking about training the doctors in our hospital at Sonia Saldes, so Saldes Queen's Hospital, we're very, very, very willing. Doctors are all very willing to speak with whatever clergy are present. Our doctor, a Jewish clergy, they're non-Jewish clergy as well, to make sure that everybody is getting the accurate information. And then the clergy person can ask him, in our situation, can ask him correctly based upon the actual facts. And you think this is a pshita, you think this is obvious, and never if it's not. Because many times they're given misinformation. So my two criteria for deciding who should be a healthcare proxy is the most important thing that I'm going to say here. This entire cheer that we're having, this entire get together, is pick a healthcare proxy. Make sure that that person is held by the family to be recognized that they're the one making the decision. Not when Nebuch the father is no longer able to make the decision. Now all of a sudden everybody pipes up and says, no, we don't like that. No, we want our rabbi. We want this. Make sure it's muskul. Make sure it's agreed to beforehand. Who's going to be passing the shilas? And then, the healthcare proxy, the family member, usually a child, not doctors. Usually it's the child, especially if it's the older parents, which that's the way you should always be. They should be about 120, should be asking 100-year-old children what they should be doing. So it's very, very important that the healthcare proxy that you pick, boy or girl, makes no difference. There's nothing in how often since it has to be a man. It should be the person that will be most at the hospital, that can speak with the doctor. It can talk and find out what the facts are. The facts from yesterday aren't the same facts as from today. It's a very dynamic, changing situation. You must get the most up-to-date facts, speaking with the most up-to-date specialist on the case. The internist may not know. The infectious disease physician may be a better person. The critical care doctor may be a better person. The palliative care doctor may be a better person. Somebody should be familiar with medical lingo. That should be the person you choose to be your healthcare proxy. When you have that, the shilas that come up can, again, vary, of course, to different posting. But the shilas that come up are related to what I call the normal routine type of care and much more intensive or aggressive type of care. And halacha differentiates between them according to all posting, just a question of how much it differentiates. So starting off at the highest interventional level, when we're dealing with certain procedures to be done, should this patient have surgery or not? We had a halacha maaseh shaila that came up at the hospital last week, and then the patient passed away. The patient required a certain GI procedure to be done. It was unfortunately a very, very, very sick patient, and the doctors all felt that the excellent chance that the patient would never die on the table when you do the procedure. They thought that obviously it wasn't vadai. If it's vadai, you can't do it. But they thought that the person was very, very sick, and what should they do? So the family said, well, it's a vadai that the patient is going to die if we don't do the procedure. It's a suffix. Is the patient going to die if we do the procedure? We're willing to take the risk. Any physicians won't be willing to do this in any event. They're not saying, I'm not doing a procedure that's such a high risk. But here it was medically appropriate or acceptable to take that risk. But they took the risk. The family made the halachic decision that they wished to go undergo the procedure. The patient survived the procedure, unfortunately passed away shortly afterwards, unclear whether it was or was not anywhere related to the procedure. But the process was done correctly. They understood what the risks were. So almost a vadai that the patient would die in a very short period of time without the procedure. There was a chance that the patient could survive with the procedure, a chance that the procedure might kill the patient. In that situation, the post can say, you're allowed to take the risk. Obviously, the more you change the facts, the more the psak will change. This is an 18-year-old child that almost certainly will die without the procedure and almost certainly will live with the procedure, then it's not a shiloh. You have to do it. Even if the family's shrying and screaming, we don't want it done. When the time is obeyed, the time is Sanhedrin, they would strap you down and you do the procedure. We don't work that way in America. I'm not suggesting that we should work that way, but you have to understand the concept. For us, pikuach nefashos is supreme. And when a life can be saved, you do everything we can to save a life. To the side. This is a terrible, terrible machlo that we have in the medical profession right now, this concept of physician-assisted suicide, which is ritzicha, it's murder. Now, I'm not suggesting that the physicians involved in this are murderers. They're very nice people. I know them. I actually chaired the panel for New York State, and there was the lone voice of five physicians that were on this that was not in favor of adopting the position that American College of Physicians should say that it's an appropriate, acceptable alternative to have a physician recommend suicide for the patient in certain situations. So I understand all of their physicians where their hearts are, but they're not speaking Das Torah. In Das Torah, no matter how compassionate you are, no matter how good you are, no matter how understanding of the patient's suffering you are, we never, ever can say that enough. Under no circumstances causing the patient to die. That is ritzicha. It is murder in halacha. Again, we're not calling, people get very upset sometimes when I say this, we're not calling anybody a murderer. We're saying that the action is an act of ritzicha. And it's halachically, absolutely not allowed. According to every posek, there's not one posek who suggests that this is permitted. So that's very important to know. But not doing the procedure is not considered ritzicha. And if a family with halachic guidance says we do not want this procedure to be done, it would be halachically 100% acceptable to say in this situation it's too much pain and suffering and we don't wish to have it done. This usually occurs in patients that have a terminal illness where there is no medical hope. The Moshe Zatzal, the Ibris Moshe, clearly states when there is no medical therapy that will cure the patient and all you're doing is prolonging the death of the patient and all you're doing is prolonging the suffering of the patient. It's a big machlokes in the Rayashi and the Moshe as to whether an unconscious patient can feel pain and suffering. But everybody agrees that we do know that he has pain and suffering. And not machuyim, and sometimes you might not be allowed to, especially if the patient expresses the interest, I'm in pain and suffering, I do not want this procedure to be done. And they have a terminal illness. It's not like, okay, I don't want to fix my broken bone because it's going to hurt, but then I'm going to live 120 years. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a person has a terminal illness for which the Moshe says, we're talking about there is no halachic medical therapy. So then halachically, they're not mechuyev to do something against the patient's wishes. Everybody agrees that if the patient wishes to undergo the pain and suffering, they have a halachic right to do so. Even though risk-benefit is very high in that situation, they're willing to undergo another round of chemotherapy, they're willing to undergo this invasive procedure for the chance that they might live. So then, post-decision, the patient can make that decision. When we don't know what the patient wants, the family has to try to figure out as best as possible what they think the patient would have wanted. The next level of question that we usually get is, what about putting in feeding tubes? What about putting in dialysis? What about putting in other significant artificial measures to improve the patient's health? And here again, you have not unanimity amongst the posters, but in general, the Psaka of Myrabe, Shafta Shlita, Guru Shlita, going in accord with the opinion of Moshe Feinstein, is that if something is painful and suffering to the patient, whether we can actually detect that pain or suffering or not, most of the people was, if they were suffering beforehand, even though they're now unconscious, we still assume that they are suffering. So then you're not mechuyev to do it. Doesn't mean you're not allowed to, but you're not mechuyev to do that type of care in a terminal patient. The other post would disagree. Remember, recently I had a conversation with somebody, he asked me to pass a shelter in the hospital, and I asked him who the Rabbi was. They said, oh, the person who was different was a common Rabbi Yashin. They said, well, it's a different story. The Rabbi Yashin Pesach is totally different than the Moshe Pesach. And make sure that that's what the family wants to do. They want to follow the Pesach of the Moshe, they want to follow his Rebbe. And they get open and said, no, they want to follow his Rebbe, Rabbi Yashin. So there was a different Pesach halacha. Neither one is right, neither one is wrong. But it's wrong in halacha to follow somebody that's not the Rebbe. You should follow the Rebbe, Aseh L'Chorah. So in the putting in of a feeding tube or something like that, so there are a number of different considerations that have to go into play. In general, for something like dialysis, put my feeding tube in a second, we view in halacha each act of dialysis as a separate act. So we can't withdraw a breathing tube. In general, once a person is intubated, they have a tube put inside them to breathe, and then you can't remove it. That is, unfortunately, an act of rutsicha, an act of murder. You know, you're doing it for the most compassionate reasons, and the patient may be suffering. He's still not allowed to do anything that causes the person to pass away. But you are allowed to not do a new act, even though that not doing the act will cause the patient to never pass away. So each act of dialysis is considered halachically a separate act. So if they dialyze the patient on Monday, but they're in pain and they're suffering, and they have a terminal illness, that the dialysis is not going to be just something to get them through until they get better. But the dialysis is just prolonging that person's pain and suffering and just delaying their death. So then we view each act of dialysis as a new act, and you have the right to say, well, we did the dialysis on Monday, we choose not to do the dialysis on Wednesday. And that's halachically acceptable. You have the same question that arises with the feeding tube. Now, the vast majority of the posting here say that giving food and water is not something that you have a choice on. The vast majority of the posting say that in this situation, you can't say, well, I'm putting in a new bag of the feeding tube, so that's a new mice. There are posting that say that under certain situations, you're not mechuyev to put in a feeding tube. You're certainly not even mechuyev to insert a feeding tube into that procedure, but even not to necessarily continue the tube feeding. Those situations must be discussed with the Rav who is familiar with the entire story. You can never possibly have the sheer that you heard, and you can never possibly have that in the abstract. The final question, and I'll discuss before we take questions, is what about oxygen? This is an even more basic question. Can you lower the oxygen? So there's a very beautiful sugya that came out ladies at Sal, and Rav Shlomo Zalman at Sal talked about it. And there may be a heter in certain situations to decrease the oxygen in a patient on a respirator who is stable at the lower oxygen. And then, as long as they remain stable, you're not obligated to then increase the oxygen back when they get never unstable. But in general, you're not allowed to withhold oxygen therapy for a patient. So if they need the oxygen, you can't turn the oxygen off. That would be the equivalent of pulling the tube, which halakhically is not acceptable. So I used up my time. I know people probably have a lot of questions about it. I'm sure myself. So I'll ask you to please address the question to one of us. And as you said, we're going to the session is scheduled to 1 o'clock. We'll take all the questions if you have.
It's for you. There's a form that the doctors...
Most. This is a special form that tries to predict in advance what you want done in certain situations. It's a very important form. It's an end-of-life form. It's a good form, but it must be used in conjunction with the healthcare proxy and the RUC. And you shouldn't be making decisions when you're 20 years old, what you want to do, when you're 80 years old, and you're having a little trouble breathing. So you really you need to know the facts.
My question is, if there's a DNR option, there's an intubation option, if the person in question is stable but has progressive dementia, and you know the functions are decreasing, things like that, and the doctor recommends that you sign this in the event that the patient ends up in the hospital in a critical care situation, are we able to sign it?
So the question is, for those that might not have heard it, can you sign a MOLS form or a DNR type of a form, which means do not resuscitate, or if this situation comes up, you don't want the patient to be intubated or resuscitated, is that halakhically allowable? My answer to that is, it depends. You can't give general answers to these questions.
So then we don't sign it.
So there's nothing wrong in signing it once you've spoken with the Rav, and the Rav says it's okay. My mother, Shalom, was on a respirator for the last almost year of her life. We did everything kalocha. I didn't want to pass it to myself. I discussed everything with my Rebbe. And she did require intubation, which the doctors would not have recommended. And the outcome was not as we would have certainly have liked, because she certainly would have liked to get off the respirator, but she never was able to get off the respirator. But to this day, I don't worry that I did anything wrong, because I asked the shayla, and I did everything kalocha.
So you intubated against the doctors?
So it wasn't against the doctor's wishes. The doctor said, I wouldn't intubate in that situation. But doctors, even if they were in the yarmulke, aren't posted. And the standard medical approach is not necessarily what the halacha suggests. So you can have an erlich affirmed doctor, but if he's not a posted, so we tend to be merciful. Doctors in general are merciful people. They really do want to do most of the time what's in the best interest of the patient. And they see so much pain and suffering in the hospital that the default position is, why are you going to mutch them? Halacha doesn't recognize that position. Halacha recognizes do not butcher them when it's halachically appropriate not to butcher them. Halacha says this is not called butchering sometimes. So each case is different, and a person must ask the shayla. Otherwise, you know, it's a good coach or not. I'll take my chances. Nobody would do that. Has to have hashgacha. Your medical actions need to have hashgacha.
Where is one supposed to leave all these medical directives? In your house and let people know where it is? Or with the rabbi, or with your... Where are you supposed to keep these things?
I'll tell you, the worst place to leave it is with the rabbi. There's no way that he's going to be contacted until it's way too late.
So the
ENT, the Hatzolah people will tell you, the first thing they do is they look on the refrigerator for a magnet with the MOLS form or a DNR form, because that's where they tell you to put it. So when you're entering into a house and somebody is sick, they will look there, or they will ask, is there a DNR form? Because these shadows come up all the time. And not every person needs to go to the hospital and medical to pass away. It's sometimes very appropriate to have wonderful home care and to take care of all of the things that person needs in their house. Other times, it's extremely important to bring the person into the hospital. If you're a regular at the hospital will keep the form on file in your medical record. And with EMRs today, electronic medical records are a lot easier. There's a state initiative called EMOLS, where they put the MOLS form online. Any hospital, any place that you go to can access that form.
But that's assuming that the people are computer savvy.
No, absolutely not. You can be totally non-computer savvy and they will do it for you. But you have to have contact with the healthcare world.
In other words, I have my cousin and him and his wife as my healthcare proxies.
Right.
So I thought that I fax it to them so they have it.
So they should certainly have it. But are they going to be in your house at 120 when that solar comes? So they
could
have.
I mean, I don't mean to be morbid. I could live another whatever. Chas v'shalom, when I walk out, I could be hit by a car.
So
in my wallet through NASP,
exactly
I have.
There are forms in the wallet that people carry them. Again, Hatzola isn't going to start rightfully through your wallet. That's what doctors do, but that's always not. And they're not gonna take that time out to look for a form when a person is coding, a person is never sick in front of them.
So that just
if
there's
a family member that's in, it says they have a DNR, so then they will stop. And in an emergency room, one of the first questions they ask in this situation is, what is the patient's preferences? And if that is documented someplace, they will try to always follow the patient's preferences. Not kalacha, but they'll follow the medical, secular ethics of following the patient's preferences. But if you have filled your forms out with a halachic advisor, then you're both okay with the medical side, the secular side, as well as the halachic side. You had a question before.
Yes, thank you. It's sort of a two-part question. If given the right information, can we assume that every congregational rav is qualified to paskin on end-of-life and medical shilas? And if not, then one would want to go to somebody who is, and then would you need to have the rav's permission to have a secondary rav?
So, well, each may give you a different answer, but I think we'll give the same answer. And that is, a rav is one of the most important people in your lives. Every rav wants to have a seil chalav. I don't pass in certain shabbos, even though I know the answer, without discussing it with my rav. I don't want to take that up right. So that's an extremely, extremely difficult question. Last week, which actually Gadol Yisrael referred to me, and I said, I don't want to pass this until I discuss it with that Gadol. So we discussed it, and we came up with a psak halacha that was a very lenient psak halacha, I think the correct psak halacha, very, very, very difficult shayla. If I didn't have that expertise, I wouldn't begin to approach a shayla, but I wouldn't turn my congregant away. When they asked me a very difficult conscious question, which I'm not equipped to, I said, I'll get back to you. And I call up whoever I think is an appropriate person to use the consultant from the rabbinical halachic side, and we discuss it with them. If it's well beyond my comprehension to even transfer the information back, I say, I'd like to have my speak with you. And you can discuss it directly with them. I do think that the community rough, very famous story, I heard from Rashomu Zalman, somebody once came to him and asked him a shayla. And Rashomu Zalman started pacing and walking towards the window. The person says, ooh, I stumped Rashomu Zalman. So Rashomu Zalman calls him to the window. He says, young man, you see that house over there? That's your Rebbe. Ask this shayla to your Rebbe. The local rav is supposed to be the person that a person goes through the sakura. Leave it to the local rav to decide what he feels comfortable passing and what he doesn't. And then the local rav will go.
I made a strategic move when I started in the Young Israel Forest Hills. I knew that this might be potentially an issue, so I had Rabbi Glack come for Shabbos. So everyone knew who we're going to with any of the medical related shadows. Now everyone feels much more comfortable. But no, for sure, it's exactly what Rabbi Glad said. Certain things you feel comfortable with. If you don't feel comfortable, then just every one of your rabbis should have their own rabbi that they should for sure consult with. I know I'm very lucky again, but that is certainly the case. You should certainly feel comfortable to approach them and know that they will not take it on their shoulders if they do not have that ability.
Asking this question for a cousin who couldn't be here. Her mother is in a coma for almost 2 years. She was in a facility until Medicare wasn't covering it anymore. She brought her home and she sleeps in a bedroom with the hospital bed with her mother, the aide, and herself. It's a terrible situation. Until then, she slept in a chair in the facility every single night for a year and a half. She's on a feeding tube. She had been an Alzheimer's patient. She's on a feeding tube and the whatever it is to make her breathe. And respirator. And it's a terrible situation. And she speaks to me. When she tells me, oh, I took my mother to the hospital, I go, you took your mother to the hospital? She goes, yeah, she couldn't breathe. And I'm saying to myself, why are you doing this? Let her go. I knew her very well. Excuse me? Because that's...
So for those that may not be able to hear the question, it's a very tragic case, and this happens all the time. If somebody is... in a situation where it's described as a coma. Coma is a technical term that
she hasn't talked or anything.
It's not one size fits all. So depending on a lot of factors, there could be different shilas. That's why I'm not passing any shilas here in public. Every case needs to be discussed. What we're trying to do is raise awareness of how to discuss a shila. So in a case like this, where a person has absolutely no prognosis medically to return to any one of a of a baseline condition, a normal condition, we're going to do different posting that will tell you the different things that you're required to do. There are certain posting that say that you do not have to go and treat such a patient in a hospital, and that you can try and do the best that you can. Every posting will say you can't pull the tumor. Most posting will say you cannot pull the feeding, and that you need to continue the feeding. But many posting will say don't give this patient the flu vaccine. Everybody in this room should get flu vaccine. This would be the only patient that you would not necessarily say you have to give them the flu vaccine. This would be the type of patient that you can make a decision on. We're going to treat you, if we're going to treat you, at home with an oral antibiotic, or if they have intravenous, with an intravenous antibiotic at home, and not bring you to the hospital, we can do an awful lot of damage, and not some good. And maybe save the patient when maybe halachically you wouldn't be obligated to do so. These are the shadows that must be discussed with the Rav, who's familiar with the true medical facts of the case. And then, depending on the Rav, you will get different answers. There are many Rabbanim in this situation that would say you're not mechuyav to bring the patient to the hospital. There are other Rabbanim that would say you are mechuyav to bring the patient to the hospital. It's not a crystal clear answer. You need to know who the patient's Rav was and how they passed you. I don't know if I get any closer to the microphone, but I will try. Okay. So basically what I said was you really need to ask the particular Shaila to the particular Rav who is the Rav of that patient, because you will get different answers. There are many situations in that you described where I would paskin based upon my Rabbanim that you're not mechuyav to go and admit the patient to the hospital. But never would I say that you could take the patient off the oxygen and take the patient off the
intubation. I don't suggest that.
No, I'm not saying you are. I'm just trying to give the general ramifications.
First, I will start with using the term terminal. And I think that generally terminal is defined in the secular world as 6 months. So, for example, a patient can go to hospice if they're expected to live no more than 6 months. And to what extent would you consider that terminal, or would we say, well, there is a substantial amount of ayesha'ah, and that as long as the patient will not necessarily go through a tremendous amount of pain or suffering, we should do everything we can to try to prolong his life. That's the first part of this.
So the question, for those who might not have been able to hear it, was, how do we define terminal? Is it 6 months? So in Allah, we have a concept of chayisha, a temporary shorter period of expected lifespan. We usually use the time sequence there of 12 months. So in the secular world, there are certain insurance and other ramifications where they use 6 months. Lamia's dat is not a machlokas. It's not a real difference of opinion. In halacha, I use the understanding of somebody as terminal as opposed to somebody has a reversible illness. If somebody is in an extreme difficult situation, but there is the potential to reverse that, even though 95% chance that you won't, I don't consider that person chayisha, a temporary. I consider that person the potential for a full life. And I would recommend in that situation, and this comes up all the time when a person unfortunately gets an acute, either medical or traumatic illness, and they ask me what to do. A person, Rahman's son, has a terrible stroke, and it looks very bleak. And the doctors say, most patients don't recover from this. And I have seen, Baruch Hashem, patients recover from it, even though most won't. So in the acute setting, I tend to be machmir and say you should do everything, because we don't know. And when you don't know, that's not a terminal illness. That's not something that's totally irreversible. If somebody has end-stage cancer, it spread nebuch over all their body, Rahman al-Islam. In that situation, I don't really say, well, if you start this chemotherapy, there's a study that says 8 months, another study that says 4 months. That's a decision that the family member himself, the person who's sick, he or she, or whoever's the healthcare proxy making the decisions, should decide, yes, we think we want to take that risk despite the pain and suffering, or no, we don't. I don't think halacha, I don't think medicine, can really distinguish between 4-month life expectancy and an 8-month life expectancy for any individual patient. people look at these studies and they say, well, there's a 4-month life expectancy if you use a therapy. It doesn't mean every patient. Some patients are 12 months, some patients are 16 months, some patients are 2 weeks. So they're aggregates, they're estimates. So the medical detail is not halakhically sufficient to be able to say 6 months, 8 months, 9 months. To me, it's, is it reversible or not? Remotion clearly states where it's not reversible. The person has no cure. All you're doing is prolong your life, then you take into account pain and suffering. The person has the right not to take pain and suffering. The person has the right to take pain and suffering. In the absence of that person being able to give it, the family has to decide what that person, the healthcare proxy has to decide what that person would have wanted. The second question.
I remember reading that there was a major dispute between the blind and the tender, which is both as well, with regard to the removal of the surgery. I remember the breathing tube or the feeding tube or whatever. Is that still an ongoing dispute?
So the question was regarding a famous machlokas. It's not just a black or a tender, but Shrita. It is a question of brain death. How do we define cessation of life? There's a standard way that Bar Yuma Pidal tells us how to define it, either circulatory or respiratory, and then there's a whole discussion about a mission all of those that tells us that you might be able to define it by chopping off the head. And based upon an animal, the animal's still moving after its head's chopped off, we still consider it metame from that point in time. It's able to be ritually impure even though it's moving about. So there is an opinion, which is the official opinion of the Rabbanut HaRashi in Eretz Yisrael, possibly the opinion of Rav Moshe Zatzal, possibly the opinion of Rav Shlomo Zalman Zatzal and others, great Rabbanim, that holds that brain death, the cessation of all circulation to the brain, in the higher parts of the brain, is halachic death. There's a position, Rav Yashiv, Meyerbein, Rav Shechter, Rav Rilik Shlita, and many others, Rav Leich Shlita, that hold that it's not brain death. There's an opinion that says maybe it is, maybe it isn't. The Rabbi Lichtenstein's itself. And therefore, they hold therefore the Chumra that you can't consider such a person dead. And that's essentially the machlokes over here. If the person is dead, so then it's Nivul HaNeis to continue doing everything. If the person's not dead, it's Ritzicha to not continue doing everything. There's a fundamental machlokes which we're not going to come to an answer over here. Eid Ve'elu Diriyot Yom Chayim, you have great posts on both sides. This has ramifications in Afghanina in regards to accepting a heart or a lung transplant and other types of transplants. There's halacha nice ramifications in terms of who should be paying for all of this care. Unfortunately, in Canada, it's become a big problem. In the United States, still a problem. In some places, less of a problem, but becoming more of a problem. Okay, New York State law, as well as every other state in the United States, accepts brain death as death. There is an accommodation built into New York State law that says we can accept the family's disagreement. What happens, and it will happen, when an insurance company says, great, we consider the patient dead. Their insurance policy is over. If you consider them alive, you're welcome to continue doing so on your own dollar. And that's when I think the question will suddenly become much more pertinent to people, when you're starting to deal with your own pocket rather than dealing with somebody else's pocket. But the halachic ramifications are very clear. If you hold brain death as legal halachic death, the patient's dead. If you hold that the brain death is not halachic death, the patient may be a gosis at the end of life, may not even be a gosis. So then you're absolutely not allowed to do anything to that patient that would eliminate care that you're providing already.
The patient's situation is reversible, okay? But so whatever reason the patient themselves just given up, they don't want to do it.
So, Rav Shechter Shlita used to give this example. He said he had an 18-year-old kid that went skiing. Right? He's a big athlete, top-notch athlete. And then he gets into a skiing accident, and they tell him, okay, you have to amputate your leg. It will save your life, 100%. If you don't amputate the leg right now, you're going to die. Kid says, if I don't have my legs, it's not worth living. He's alert, he's oriented, he's conscious, he meets all the mentis compass criteria. Two psychiatrists saw it, they agree, he understands. Rav Shechter Shlita said, at least in the time of the Sanhedrin, and not talking about the United States, you anesthetize the guy, you chop off his legs, and you save his life. It's not a shiloh. Again, I'm not talking practical. Don't quote me saying you should go into the hospital and do this. But that's the theory behind the halachia. It's a reversible situation. It's pikuach nefashos. You're mechuyev to do everything. If it's Shabbos, you would do this. If it's Tuesday, you do this. Mechuyev to do it. That's not the typical case. The typical case is person is an elderly person, has a stage 4 cancer, metastatic disease, and they tell him, you know, we'll give you another round of chemotherapy, we'll buy you a couple more months. That person has the right to make that decision. So if it's reversible, then we would say the person should undergo it. Now, but Moshe also talks about what happens if the person refuses. So Moshe says, we don't force feed the person. The person says, I don't want to feed you to put it. In a situation where putting in a feeding tube will prolong the patient's life and save them, they're not in pain and suffering. So Moshe says you try to talk the person into putting in a feeding tube. But if he ultimately refuses, you don't put it in against his will. So you try as best as you can to have the person do what is halachically right. If they choose not to, we don't sedate them, we don't put it in against their wishes. And that's halachically, not only sanctuable. I think we have time for one last question.
We did put in a feeding tube, and I do believe it saved my mother's life. But now she's eating better orally, but she wants it out. And she is not 100% mentally fit. I mean, she's in and out of dementia or whatever it is, but she wants the tube out. She's still pulling at it.
So the question is, you have a feeding tube replaced, and Baruch Hashem, you don't need it anymore. Are you allowed to take it out? So halachically, you're certainly allowed to take it out. You may need to put it in again later on. But that's a different child. I would recommend...
So
I would recommend not taking it out only because it doesn't hurt to keep it in and not use it. You're not required to use it, but I wouldn't take it out. So that would be my professional general recommendation. Don't take out something when it's not causing any harm and you may need to put it back in a short while. But if the condition that went away, let's say she had a GI problem that was cured and there will be no need for feeding tube, then avada you take it out. There's no absolute, that's not called removing something that will hasten death. No, that's called good medical care. And there's no halachic problem in removing the feeding tube that's in place when it's absolutely not needed. That all the person would say you can take out. The question would be, if she really can't survive without the feeding tube, so the vast majority of posts would say don't pull it out in that situation. There are many posts that would say you're not going to put it in that situation. One of the most misunderstood medical areas is the value of artificial nutrition through a feeding tube in terms of whether it prolongs life or not. All the studies show it doesn't prolong life. The only time a feeding tube should be put in it is if the patient has a life that they will live, where if you don't give them the food, they will die. But not that the feeding tube will prolong their life. All these cancers that look, the cachexias and stuff like that, that you get with cancer, the feeding tubes don't prolong life. All they do is they give you a way to give them nutrition, which doesn't impact the life. More important is hydration in those situations. As opposed to somebody that doesn't have a terminal illness, if you don't feed them, they will die. That's a different story. But if you think that the feeding tube will actually prolong their life because of the food, that's just simply not medically true. So again, I don't know the facts of this particular case. If somebody has stage 4 terminal cancer and they're going to be dead in 1 month, I never would ever put in a feeding tube in that patient. It will not reverse anything. But that's assuming those are the correct facts. Those aren't the correct facts. Then no, then I'm not saying that. A feeding tube doesn't prolong life. A feeding tube provides nutrition. Nutrition may or may not be essential depending on the person's stage of life. So that's the key that I want to make. So on behalf of Rabbi Ashi Schreier and myself, we want to thank you for listening to us. And it's a shame it should only be a hot tube pro out here and not be real halacha nice and shy.
Oh,